happened? What happened?
You got shot.
What's your name? Wake up. What's your name?
Shit.
If there ever was a time, it would be now. That's all I'm saying. If there ever was a time to get on your feet, take it to the street. Cause you're the one that's getting played right now by the game they're playing. Come on, meet me down at the Cardi Park and say, oh, where are the
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. And as always, you're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com or Community Progressive Radio. As my hearing date with the federal government, which is trying to compel me to fork over information about myself and its fruitless quest to collect money from me, I thought I would finally interview my friend, hero, and someone who has personally sacrificed much in his own personal quest for peace, someone who was also born on the 4th of July, as is our other friend, Ron Kovic, Brian Wilson. I'll let Brian tell you his story, but before we bring Brian on, I want to read a bit from his blog at brianwilson.com. Brian says, I was once a young man, very much like the young men and women who have gone to Iraq and Afghanistan as U.S. military soldiers. I grew up believing in the red, white, and blue. I believed that the United States had a sacred mission to spread democracy around the world. Vietnam was my generation's war. I did not volunteer, but when I was drafted, I answered the call. It was in Vietnam that my journey toward a different kind of knowledge began. Brian's newest book is an autobiography called Blood on the Tracks. Brian, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thanks for having me.
I'm glad I finally got you on the show. I've been wanting to have you on for a long time now. But Brian, we have about 25 minutes, and your story is very compelling, and you've been on a very long journey. But today I'd like to cover three things, if we have the time. Why and how you found yourself on this journey, especially your conscientious objection to paying income taxes, because I have a hearing coming up with the federal government that the IRS has asked for, and what you're doing today about on your journey, where you are on the path.
Okay.
So let's start with your background. Before you came on, I read a quote from your blog that says that you willingly went to Vietnam as a patriotic young American, but that experience quickly changed your life. Can you tell my listeners a bit about that experience when you were serving in Vietnam?
I had some doubts before I went to Vietnam. I had been in the military 2 years before I got my orders to go to Vietnam, and I was still a believer in the fight against communism, as I was taught. But I was having some doubts about the war, but not enough to create any moral crisis within me. But after I'd been in Vietnam about 1 month, I was involved with a situation where I was observing the after effects of bombings of what I was told were targets, and the targets in each case were inhabited fishing villages. And in 1 week's time, I observed, witnessed somewhere between 700 and 900 murdered Vietnamese civilians, more than half of whom were children. And at that point, I had a meltdown, an emotional, psychological meltdown. I didn't collapse, but I had a crisis in my, I guess you'd say it was a moral crisis. I went to my superiors, and I was a first lieutenant at the time, and I said, "This can't be something that we're involved in consciously, intentionally." And I found out that it was a deliberate policy. We wanted body counts, and so from that point on, I knew I was on a different track. I didn't really even want to be on a different track, but I was, and I realized that I was the savage, I was the enemy, and that was a startling thing to realize. And I was 27, so I wasn't 18 or 19 or 20. already had a master's degree, embarrassingly. Nonetheless, I understood that something terrible was happening and that I had been terribly brainwashed. And so when I got out of the military, fortunately, without being court-martialed, I started studying the history, not just of the U.S., but of what we call Western civilization, and mm-hmm. just continually was shocked at realizing that virtually everything we called civilized was built on massive exploitation and lies. And so that just, you know, gradually marginalized me. I couldn't adapt mm-hmm. to the culture. And my father would, you know, he was always saying, you're marginalizing yourself, you're marginalizing yourself. And I said, well, what's my choice? I'm realizing that everything I learned was not true. And so now I want to learn more about the truth. So my life, pretty much since 1970 when I got out of the military, has been a journey of unraveling from the lies and rediscovering my humanity. And, of course, in the process, discovering lots of other people that were in similar states of kind of awareness shock. And so that pretty much has guided my journey, even though I stumble and collapse here and there and get back up again. And but at any rate, looking at the eyes of the Vietnamese villagers that were dead at my feet mm-hmm. Has stayed with me as a very powerful image of realizing that I and those people at my feet were all part of one web of humanity, and that has just never left me. I mean, it's just indelibly etched into my DNA, and there's nothing I can do about it except honor it and, in a sense, celebrate the fact that everything and everybody's connected. And, of course, that's very different from how I was raised and how most of us were raised. And mm-hmm. And so, you know, people call you a radical when you think this way, but to me it's just unfolding organically of saying and seeing things from my own experiences that tell me something very different from what I had been taught. And, you know, those of us who are in various stages of being awake understand to some extent, and others to a great extent, the fact that we are involved in a process of recovering our humanity from an incredible legacy of being conditioned by patriarchy, by vertical power complexes. I mean, this goes back millennia, so it's not something. I mean, in writing my book, Blood on the Tracks, The Life and Times of S. Brian Wilson, I was answering the question that motivated the book, which was, how was it so easy for a young kid like me, who was considered such a good boy when I was growing up, how could I have obeyed an order so easily, really, to go 10,000 miles, 9,000 miles from my hometown to participate in killing other people who I did not know? That's an absurd thing, but it's been going on for a long time, and I wanted to understand mm-hmm. how this happens throughout history, and what are the patterns, and what are the points at which human beings kind of got severed from some basic connection with the earth and mutual respect, even if we have disagreements. Do we just follow an order to kill somebody? I mean, that's insane.
It is totally insane. The more I learn about you, the more I'm amazed at how my journey has paralleled yours a lot. And just before we go on, tell my listeners why. I'm sure most of my listeners know your story and know about you, but in case there's somebody out there who doesn't, why did you call your book Blood on the Tracks, and really what led you to those tracks in Concord?
Well, Blood on the Tracks, the title of my book, you have to know the subtitle, Life and Times of S. Bryant Wilson, because otherwise you'll get directed to Bob Dylan's song. The Blood on the Tracks is my blood on the tracks at the Concord Naval Weapons Station in California, where I was almost killed on September 1st, 1987, when I and two other veterans were involved in a very well-publicized, nonviolent block of the movement of a 5-mile-an-hour munitions train that was carrying weapons from the storage bunkers at that base to the ships in Sacramento River, just really 2 miles away from the bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
And those weapons were going to El Salvador and Nicaragua during Reagan's wars against the campesinos of Central America in the 80s. And I had been I had spent a lot of time in Nicaragua and Salvador before that, so I was really just now going to the place where the weapons were coming from to kill the people that I had been with in Central America, and I considered those people my family, just as I had discovered in Vietnam that we're all part of an extended family. And basically I wanted to interfere with the movement of munitions that were going to murder people, since Congress wasn't going to stop funding the war. So, Blood on the Track, I was run over by the train going 17 miles an hour,
mm-hmm.
More than 3 times its speed limit, and we found out later that the train crew was ordered not to stop that day because two of the three veterans that were on the tracks that day were considered by the FBI's domestic terror suspects, which of course was again another shocking discovery.
Mm-hmm.
What? And mm-hmm. And they said they feared that we were going to hijack the train, which was, you know, on 2 miles of tracks, protected by 350 armed Marines. It's so bizarre that, you know, again, it's hard for people to even to this day grasp that the train crew was ordered to run over us. Essentially, it was ordered not to stop,
mm-hmm.
knowing that we were on the tracks. So, but of course, my consciousness that led me to going to Central America in the first place really originated back to Vietnam, where I started my first, my first kernels of being awakened to something that was going on in the world that I didn't really understand, and I really wanted to understand it. And I was motivated by looking at the eyes of those Vietnamese villagers, because that's where I discovered my humanity.
And that was a courageous act, trying to stop those munitions from going to Central America. And, you know, people tell me that I have courage all the time, and, you know, I don't really think that way because I'm just doing what I think that
exactly.
I think
yeah.
is right. And, you know,
exactly.
I'm trying to rediscover my humanity also. But something that really terrifies people in the country we live in is the Internal Revenue Service, that, you know, people are afraid to step out of line when it comes to paying federal income taxes. But I became a tax resistor, a conscientious income tax objector after my son was killed in Iraq. I feel like I paid, I was a tax-paying, what the establishment would consider a tax-paying, law-abiding citizen up to then. You know, I feel like the years that I did pay my taxes, I helped pay for the murder of my own son, let alone, you know, the murder of innocent Vietnamese and Iraqi and Afghans and on and on and on and on and on and on and on. So when Casey was killed, at first it was an objection to him being killed in an illegal memorial war. Now it's an objection to all the murder and exploitation of everybody is why I don't pay my taxes. Why did you become an income tax resister? I know why you did, but what was the process? You told a really engaging story when we were speaking together in upstate New York that one time. Tell my listeners about your story.
Well, in the late 70s, I was living in upstate New York. I was actually farming. I was part of my post-Vietnam kind of therapy, almost. And I was beginning to read a lot about what was going on in Nicaragua and Salvador, actually in 79, when the Sandinista revolution was successful, and the Salvadoran, there was a coup in Salvador to overthrow the repressive government of Salvador, and that Jimmy Carter was concerned about these changes that the Sandinistas had overthrown Somoza, and that the Salvadoran coup was overthrowing our trusted government there that was protecting the oligarchy. And I started thinking, wow, this is going on all the time, and it's going on with our money and my money. Now, I started thinking about, I really got to not pay money to the government, because it's like directly contributing to murder of innocent people, and it's a violation of international law to do that. But it took me about 3 years to figure out, I really started, well, it was a process of thinking about it, talking to people about it, thinking about it, talking to people about it, and realizing that sooner or later, if I was a tax refuser or a tax resister, I would have to really deal with the IRS and in the end probably have to pay fines and so forth, even if I started with not paying, or at least figuring out ways to reduce what I send to the government. So I finally decided that I was going to be a tax, what I call a tax refuser, which I distinguish from being a tax resister. And what I mean by that is I wanted to absolutely refuse any payment to the government such that they could never collect even, I could never collect even if they took me into court, because I would simply refuse to agree, I would refuse to comply with a judge's order to cooperate. And so I realized I had to be prepared to go to prison. And so what I did was I knew that I had to be self-employed, so there was no withholding taken out of my pay. I had to get rid of all my property, which I did at the time when I started this. I owned a house in Western Mass. I had left my farm. I actually lost my farm to a divorce in New York and was working in Massachusetts. And I owned a house, and I sold the house. I got rid of my bank accounts and filed accurate returns for 4 years with the IRS as a self-employed person, which indicated that I, according to their laws, I owed them so much money each year, and I sent them a letter each year saying, with my income tax return accurately filled out, but in the space where it says tax owed, I would have an asterisk, that C-attached letter. And the letter would explain why, under the Nuremberg principles, I could not pay for the crimes of my government. And I was obligated, not only by international law and therefore by the Constitution, but my conscience. And so I knew sooner or later I was going to, and this was all happening before I got run over by the train, I knew that sooner or later I was going to probably go to prison. But that was what was the hardest part in my deliberation process was I had to feel comfortable with the idea of going to prison. And when I finally got comfortable with that idea, I felt so free. And I think I had a dozen meetings with the IRS over many years. And I could always be calm with them because I knew I was on my ground. Mm-hmm. I was following what I really believed. And they had all the cards in their court except one. And that was they could not make me do something I didn't believe in.
Good.
And I knew that I was ready to do my 2 years or whatever was going to be in prison. So that always enabled me to be calm with them. And my lawyers always said, you're going to do time in prison. And I said, I'm ready.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to do it, but I'm ready.
Right.
And so for me, that was a tax refusal. I was absolutely refusing to pay, and I knew I had to change my lifestyle. And I paid for 12 years, or maybe more, I paid all my bills with postal money orders because I had no bank account. I had no checking account. I had no savings account. I had nothing they could seize except my body.
Right.
And that actually put me in a position. I felt that I was always, I felt like I was kind of in charge.
Well, you know, I've done the same thing. I don't own anything, and I think the IRS think that, you know, they quite don't believe that, you know, I don't have, like, an offshore bank account somewhere, but, you know, I seriously don't. I divested myself of all of my, you know, anything that they could seize. I have books, and I have clothes, and I have my computer, and I have my loved ones, and, you know, those are the most important things. But that's not the American way of life, is it, Brian?
No,
I think that scares people more than going to prison, is they would have to live a simple life. But to me, it's so liberating.
Yeah.
And that brings me to, I can't believe we're almost out of time already, but that brings me to my final question. What are you doing today? What is your life? What is your work like? What stage of your path are you on today?
Well, I'm still doing book talks, so I'm still promoting Blood on the Tracks, which is in its second printing. I am writing a book on the history of U.S. intervention in Korea that goes back to 1945, and I'm very involved in what's happening on Jeju Island in South Korea, which probably very few people know about, but it's U.S. and Korea are building a deep-port Aegis destroyer, missile-equipped destroyer base at a very pristine location. It's part of the Obama's encirclement of China strategy. And I'm involved here in Portland, Oregon, with Portland Transition, and I'm involved in a deep energy reduction group where we're discussing radical ways of further simplifying our lives as an attempt to model for others ways of actually liberating ourselves from our dependency on all this stuff that we grew up believing we had to have. And I'm involved in a lot of permaculture stuff right in my own yard. I'm mapping all the plants, and of which there are 600, I think, in my own yard. I'm mapping them all. I'm understanding them, trying to, because the microbes in the soil will one day soon maybe even be greeting my body as it gets ready for compost. I'm 71 now, so it's like I have to be thinking about my integration into the earth. And I'm very involved in supporting this new group of Veterans for Peace called the Veterans Peace Teams, which are training in nonviolence to be present where there are likely confrontations between nonviolent demonstrators and the police, such as in Occupy. And so these Veterans Peace Teams will be prepared when asked to go and stand in between the occupiers and the police and actually take the blows. That's what the training is all about. Take the blows rather than retaliating. to demonstrate the violence is coming from the state.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, also, I don't own a car, and
excellent.
It makes it really hard to get around.
Yes,
but
it does.
I have my bike, and you, even with your prosthetics, you also, in fact, you did your book tour in California by your bike, if I understand that
correct.
Correctly.
Well, from Portland to the Bay Area, I did all my hand cycling, 750 miles, and I loved it. I don't fly, so, you know, it has limited my range of travel, but I do take Amtrak. I did my East Coast tour on Amtrak, and I'll be going to L.A. next week on Amtrak. My cycling range can vary from a kind of a normal range of 20 miles to special trips that will be as long as 1,000 miles. But I have to, you know, plan it all out and so forth, mm-hmm. which is good. I like the idea of having to plan things around ways of doing things that I think are better than just hopping on a plane, which I haven't done for 11 years.
Well, Brian, for the average American, do you feel, with your lifestyle, do you feel deprived at all?
With my lifestyle? Oh, no, I feel liberated.
Yeah.
But, you know, I feel frustrated that even my own relatives, sometimes I think that they're, I can't believe how, sometimes when I'm really angry, I call them, I use the word stupid,
uh-huh.
but certainly ignorant, and it just amazes me how people can go about their business as usual and support bombing Pakistan or talking about bombing Iran or just, I don't know, I just, the disconnect sometimes forces me to, it forces me to discipline myself into meditation and working in my garden and just trying to stay grounded, knowing that the system and how we've been conditioned is insanity, and I don't want to be insane, so I have to work hard to maintain my sense of my humility, my sense of groundedness, my clarity. Because it's all insane. The system's insane. Even calling America democratic is insane. It's like, it's just, so I just have to focus on my network of friends, and
mm-hmm.
it really helps me working in the soil. The soil is really grounding.
Absolutely. Brian, again, thank you for taking your time to be on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. And could you tell my listeners your website?
Yes, my website is BW, that's B as in Brian, W as in Wilson, at brianwilson.com. And you have to know that Wilson is spelled with two L's, so it's BRIANWILLSON. And I also have a website for my book, which is bloodonthetracks.info.
And we will post those in the notice when we send it out that you're going to be on the show. So, again, Brian, thank you for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. And thank you, I don't know if you want to be, but thank you for being such an amazing role model.
Yeah, well, I don't feel that.
Thanks for having
me on your show.
Okay, Brian, thank you. Keep up the good work.
All right.
What happened? You got shot. What's your name?
If there ever was a time, it would be now. That's all I'm saying.
Well, thank you again for listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I would like you to go to my blog and click on Occupy the IRS to find out information about my upcoming hearing, which will be the Thursday after this show originally airs. My hearing is on April 19th, and my blog is cindysheehansoapbox.blogspot.com. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Petty, my producer, Mikey, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my guest, Brian Wilson, and you, as always, for listening and supporting the show. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Peace out.
When you light a spark, everywhere you go right now, it's a party park. And News Corp says you don't have a plan. Well, sit down, man. I'll tell you again. The plan's to stand together up to green. And a tear gas can in a veteran's face won't change the case.